accuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to another edition of the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. State and local governments are under tremendous pressure to do more with less. Nowhere is this more evident than in human service delivery, that social safety net bringing to those most in need a leg up, well-being, and ultimately self-sufficiency. Today, we will explore the challenges being faced and innovations being forged in the District of Columbia with our very special guest, Clarence Carter, Director of D.C.'s Department of Human Services. Clarence, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you, Michael.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Stuart Vansky. Stuart, welcome.
Thanks, Michael. Always a pleasure.
Clarence, I'd like to start off by learning more about your department. Would you give us an overview of the mission, history, and evolution of D.C.'s Department of Human Services?
Sure, Michael. The D.C. Department of Human Services has gone through a metamorphosis over the past 10 years. It actually was one of the old mega agencies, human services agencies that used to be comprised of the Department of Youth and Rehabilitative Services and mental rehabilitation and developmental disabilities, mental health, and all of the income support agencies. And as a number of those agencies came under court action, then they were spun off into their own separate agencies. And so now the Department of Human Services principally focuses on income supports for economically and socially challenged people, homelessness, and those programs which really support fragile populations.
So what's the size of its budget? What's the scale of operations? And how many employees do you have?
Just a little south of $400 million annual operating budget. Just a little short of 900 employees is our 2010 appropriation.
Now that you've provided us with a sense of the larger organization, could you describe your role leading the Department of Human Services?
Sure. Of course, principally responsible for strategic vision, budget development, budget execution, and of course the representation of the organization before council and all other external organizations.
Given these responsibilities, what do you see as the top three challenges you face in your position, and what are you doing to address those challenges?
Top three challenges, I would say one is managing on multiple priorities. There are many different programs and initiatives of the agency, so it's managing those multiple priorities. It's also trying to fundamentally change a system while you continue to administer it, okay? We are trying to set a very different trajectory for the programs and the initiatives of the agency, but we're not allowed to shut down and open up 6 months later. We have to continue to provide those benefits, goods, and services. So trying to change what the agency is while you continue to administer it is probably the biggest challenge that we have. And particularly in this economic climate that we find ourselves, are staying in front of our homelessness issue has been a real challenge.
Prior to your current leadership, Clarence, I want to explore a little bit about yourself. I understand you worked at both the state and federal levels in the human services. Would you highlight your career path? How did you begin your career, and what brought you to your current role?
Sure, Michael. I have had the opportunity to serve a president and three governors in appointed positions in the venue of human services. My previous federal service, I served as the director of the Office of Community Services, the last remnant of the Office of Economic Opportunity created by President Johnson to fight the war on poverty. And then also in the Bush administration, I was director of the food stamp program for the country out of the Department of Agriculture. Prior to that, I served as a commissioner for the Virginia Department of Social Services under then-Governor George Allen and then also Governor Jim Gilmore. and really principally focus there on the development of welfare reform as we know it today. And prior to that, had a couple of stints in other programs and initiatives that were all about growing the capacity of low-income people. So all in all, it's been just short of 20 years in the administration of programs and agencies that were about building the capacity of socially and economically challenged people.
So with that kind of an wealth of experience, what are the key characteristics in your mind of an effective human services leader?
A few things. One, the ability to know a little about a lot, because there are literally a lot of different programs and initiatives you're currently working on. The ability to manage multiple priorities, because, again, there are many different moving parts, and you have to keep those moving parts moving all at once. And the ability, I think, to make the complex simple, because many of these programs that we operate are programs that have pretty significant and complex rule bases, but yet the public simply needs to understand that they work. And so you really do need to be able to take pretty complex programs and explain them and operate them in a very simple way.
As a follow-up, because you triggered in my mind the three different levels of government that you've been involved in, and how does each level, local, state, federal, does it require a different type of leadership in order to be effective?
So one difference from the federal level to actually the state and local level is that at the federal level, you don't administer programs. You really create policy and the rules, okay? The action happens at the state and local level. And so at the state and local level, you really do have to be much more of a hands-on administrator, somebody who is able to make the mechanism operate, as opposed to thinking about a policy construct or a rule set for how it would operate.
So with that kind of description, what's a day or a week in the life of the director of DHS in D.C.?
A typical week would be, would kick off the week with a meeting with my senior staff. We sort of want to check the pulse of where we've been and where we're going. After a senior staff meeting, we may have a meeting with a group of advocates on a particularly thorny issue. Let's take what we are attempting to do on homelessness. You know, we've had some significant issues with capacity, especially family capacity. So we might be meeting with a group of advocates explaining what our policies are on trying to address our homeless neighbors. Then could, in all likelihood, meet with a member of the mayor's senior team, where we are attempting to figure out how we are going to solve a particularly vexing problem. So we would sit with the city administrator and his team, laying out what the problem is and our recommendations for how we would solve it, and then come to some determinations for how we would go about that. Might spend a couple of evenings during the week in community forums, again, explaining to our city how they interface with DHS, addressing some concerns that they have. Certainly during the course of a week may have a meeting with either council staff or a hearing in which council is exercising its oversight function, trying to ensure that the agencies are functioning as they're supposed to. So it is a pretty wide range of from the actual administration of the organization to planning for something that's going to happen, to meeting with the community, to potentially meeting with our chief financial office to look at some budgetary aspect of the organization.
How are human services delivered in D.C.? We will ask Clarence Carter, director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can analytics and risk management lead to better decision-making? What is FEMA doing to forge a 21st century emergency response system? How is the federal government greening its operations? What are some of the opportunities and challenges facing those implementing a national health IT agenda? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out all of this and so much more in the spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Clarence Carter, Director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services. Also joining us from IBM is Stuart Vansky. Clarence, you are an outspoken advocate for reforming the way human services are delivered. As I understand it, you've pursued a first-person approach to human services delivery. What are the major problems with the way services are delivered today? And would you elaborate on this person-based, client-centric approach?
Michael, happy to. The human services system that we currently administer, and understand that the problem that I am about to lay out is not only a District of Columbia problem, it is literally a problem that exists in this country. The construct of the existing human services system is one that is an aggregation of individual categorical programs that were all meant to address some aspect of the human condition. So whether it be public assistance, whether it be housing supports, healthcare supports, literacy support, nutrition support, we developed a program to address every aspect of the human condition. And we think of them euphemistically, we call it the social safety net. Well, quite frankly, it's very much a misnomer because they're not knitted together at all. It is an aggregation of individual programs that literally don't work together to be able to take a comprehensive approach to enhancing the human condition. So the silos is the first problem that we have. The second problem is that the system that we administer is what we call program-centric. And I will give you an example. As I said, as I was the administrator of the food stamp program for the country, the food stamp program, and I need to call it by its proper name, which has been changed as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It is a principal nutrition safety net for the country, and it is about ensuring that there is economic assistance for low-income individuals and families to not starve. The three things that we measure the effectiveness of the food stamp program are, is did we get the benefit to the individual or family who was entitled to receive it? Did we get it to them in the amount that they were entitled to receive? And did we get it to them timely? Those are the three things that we measure the effectiveness of the food stamp program on. Now, you will notice that I didn't say anything about whether or not anybody was hungry. And so we measure the effectiveness on goals which are related to the program. It's my argument that we should be focusing on human well-being and not what's important to the program. And the third problem in the existing construct is that the system was not built around an exit strategy. It was built really around a maintenance strategy. As long as you meet the criterion to receive a particular benefit, good, or service, and there are resources to provide that service, you will receive it. And it's my argument that our system should be focused on trying to move as many people through it as is possible, as quickly as possible, because we don't really want the members of our society in a position where they have to come to government for their basic subsistence. And so it's those three things to me that create a construct which really is not about growing human capacity, but it is really about the administration of an aggregation of programs that really maintain human dysfunction. And so our argument in a person-first or person-centric system is that we should understand what the presenting circumstances of an individual or a family are, bring together a set of benefits, goods, and services that are dedicated to growing that individual or family beyond the need for public assistance. And quite frankly, our effectiveness should be judged on the degree to which we accomplish those objectives, the degree to which we enhance the human condition, not simply provide units of service for people who are in need. And so for us, it is a fundamentally different construct. We think if we focus on the individual, grow the capacity of that individual to be as self-sufficient as possible, we strengthen not only that individual or that family, but we strengthen our society.
So the income maintenance model, the classic entitlement model, right, has been true with a notable exception of TANF and welfare reform. Do you see welfare reform, you know, with reciprocal obligations and both consecutive and lifetime limits on eligibility for benefits, is that a model that you see that should be adopted more broadly for programs like SNAP?
I absolutely think that what we attempted to accomplish with the design of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program needs to expand to the rest of the human services apparatus. And from my perspective, you know, Stuart, we get uncomfortable when we talk about time limits. But from my perspective, the time limits allow us to have, as a community and as a person being served, a sense of urgency to be able to grow that individual or family beyond that space. And so we do see that as being a very important tenet to what the social safety net should look like. The other thing I would say, and is probably most important about how you let in there, Stuart, is the notion of mutual responsibility. We cannot, as a society, make anyone walk their life's journey. What we have to do is we have to create the enabling conditions for anyone to be able to do so. But the members of society who need this help have to meet society halfway with the created enabling conditions, availing themselves of those conditions to be able to meet their life's journey. This whole notion of somehow we can either walk the journey for someone or allow them to not walk the journey as somehow being helpful to them is failed logic. We have to have a construct not of individual responsibility, not of no responsibility, but of mutual responsibility, where society takes its role of creating the enabling conditions for every individual to enhance their quality of life, and then those individuals that need those services availing themselves to meeting that objective.
So, Clarence, you touched on earlier homelessness as an example, and I want to talk about the typical perception out there is that a homeless person is predominantly male, possibly mentally ill, and living on the street. Yet, as you pointed out earlier, the D.C. homeless issue is complex. Perhaps you could shed some light and clarify possible misperceptions. What population represents the majority that your agency serves, and who are the most at risk?
Homelessness, Michael, is a significantly complex issue. Our last point in time count. And what happens is, under HUD guidelines, every jurisdiction each January takes an evening and goes out and literally counts the number of individuals who are sleeping on the street or in shelter, okay, to determine what our homeless population is. And our last count this January was just a little bit more than 6,500 individuals are homeless in the District of Columbia. Now, that does constitute about 85% men and 15% women. And absolutely, mental illness is a factor. On any given evening, we will provide shelter services in the district. We have beds for about 980 men, about 350 women, and about 265 families. So on any given evening, we could be sheltering more than 1,300 individuals, between individuals and families in the district. And it, as I said, and there are many factors that drive the issue of homelessness. In some instances, mental health is absolutely an issue. It's not in all cases, but in some instances, issues it absolutely is. Evictions from housing is an issue that drives. In the district, a lack of affordable housing is an issue. Individuals returning from incarceration is also something that drives homelessness. So there are many factors that drive homelessness in the district. It is an amazingly complex issue.
So the other half of that coin around reducing the chronicity of street homelessness is prevention. Can you elaborate on the agency's homeless prevention strategy?
Sure. As part of the American Recovery Act, the administration made available a funding stream called Homelessness Prevention and Rapid Rehousing. And what those dollars allow us to do is actually prevent or divert an individual or family from having to come into the shelter system by paying arrears in rent or providing a first month rent and security deposit, so that providing a basic amount of support to keep folks from ever having to come into the system. And what we have found during this significant economic downturn, a number of individuals and families have found themselves in the place where if they had some small level of support, then that would help them get over the crisis and not have to come into the system. So in addition to being able to address those who are the most chronically homeless, you also want to make sure that you can keep other episodes of homelessness from ever happening by these sort of short-term interventions.
And can you tell us more about the district's homeless outreach strategy, especially during this seriously inclement weather?
Sure. We try desperately during the what we call the hypothermia season, and it starts the 1st of November until March 31st, whenever the temperature drops to 32 degrees or below. The district has, as part of its legal structure, a right to shelter. So any individual who presents as being homeless during that period, again, when the temperature meets that criterion, has a right to shelter. And so we have an outreach mechanism where we have a hotline that anyone can call when they need shelter services. We have an outreach team that actually scours particular neighborhoods to find individuals and encourage them inside. And of course, we do public service announcements both on television and on radio to let everybody know that there's a number that you can call, that if indeed an individual or a family is in need of shelter, that they can call that hotline number and we will send a van to pick them up and get them to wherever we have available shelter.
And are you exploring rather new ways to perform street outreach? And how are you continuing to ensure proper shelter capacity, that you have enough room to house those who need shelter?
We are exploring new outreach strategies. One of the things that we are currently embarking upon is a geographic information approach to identifying where, through this point in time, where we were able to identify street homeless, we're now able to use that information and actually adjust our outreach contracts to be better positioned where we actually saw many of our homeless neighbors. So we're able to adjust it through a GIS mechanism. Our shelter capacity system is one which is pretty consistently in flux. And as I had just mentioned, with our permanent supportive housing initiative, one of the things that we have been able to do is to move a number of those individuals that used our shelters the most frequently to be able moving them into housing. So then we do have the capacity to serve the single men and women that need the shelter. Now, I would tell you that we have been experiencing a dramatic rise in family homelessness. Okay, we have seen over the course of the past year a 51% increase in families presenting as homeless. And what we believe is that we are beginning to see the lagging effects of a very poor performing economy. The foreclosure doesn't happen the first day. The family, but it actually builds. And then once an individual doesn't have that housing available to them, in many instances, they may have other resources available to them. But once they've exhausted all those resources, then they find themselves as a homeless family. And this is not only a district trend, it's a national trend. While our numbers are up 51% nationally, family homelessness is up about 31% according to a recently released HUD report.
According to the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans, veterans returning from active duty often face an array of problems during transition from military to civilian life, which places them at risk of homelessness. Would you elaborate on the programs in place to assist homeless veterans in the district and how you work with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs?
Stuart, happy to. And this is another one of the signature successes of the district's homeless services initiative. We were approached by the district's VA Medical Center a little over a year ago, and they understood that we had had real success in our permanent supportive housing and identifying our homeless population. And so what they asked of us is, they said, we've got resources for veterans, so could you turn over to us the veterans that you've identified, and we will provide the considerable services of the Veterans Administration for the veterans that you've identified. Well, the person responsible for heading our program at DHS said, with all due respect, what we would like to do is we would really like to have your assistance in housing our homeless veterans. So if you would agree to partner with us, we will take the veterans that we identify and we will move them through the mechanism that we've had so much success with, our Permanent Supportive Housing Initiative. So we created the first in the nation agreement between the medical center, the Veterans Administration, and district government to house 105 veterans. Okay, we have HUD vouchers specifically for veterans. Through that agreement, we have housed 103 of the 105 veterans, and two others will be housed within the week. And we are looking to enhance that partnership with the VA. And in fact, the Senate Appropriations Committee came to visit this spring to look at how this was working. In a recently released report, highlighted the initiative between the district and the Veterans Administration as a significant best practice for how to address this. So we think that we've had some real success and look forward to solidifying this partnership and actually helping other jurisdictions create similar partnerships to address homelessness amongst our veterans population.
Clarence, I'd like to switch back a little bit, back to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And it does kind of dovetail with our earlier conversation about the need for transformation on how services are delivered. I understand that the district is looking to redesign the administration, service, and continuum of operations of the work, training, and education portions of TANF. Would you elaborate on this effort, and what are the key design elements for this prospectively new program?
Michael will be pleased to. The tenets of welfare reform, or the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, when it was designed and enacted some 13 years ago now, it was to require work for receipt of benefits and to make the benefit issuance time limited, to provide a 60-month lifetime cap on benefits. The district wanted to not have its vulnerable families fall off that 60-month cliff. And so it created a local program which would actually have the effect of having those time limits have no impact. In our zeal to be able to be compassionate and not have that cliff, we actually created a system which provided no incentive to move through it. And so many of our TANF families would just continue to receive that benefit. And so part of our redesign efforts are, one, to be intentional about trying to move families through. So the first thing that we will do in our redesign is to do a pretty intensive assessment of that family to understand what their strengths are, okay, what their challenges are, and build an individual service plan who, as I talked about from a person first perspective, is about moving that family beyond. So we would have a plan which we benchmark, which we enter into mutual agreement with that family as a plan to move them using the TANF support, but to moving them to self-sufficiency. This assessment and individual service plan is a key component. And then through this assessment, in this redesign, we will be able to assign the eligible individuals to an appropriate work or training component that meets what's important to them so that we can actually move them through. This shouldn't be just about getting someone into a dead-end or no-value job. It should be about building their skill sets, getting them into a job opportunity that can help them grow beyond. So by having a tailored assessment, by having an individual service plan, by moving them to training and to job opportunities that are specifically tailored to them, we believe that we will be able to move families through this episode onto greater degrees of self-sufficiency.
What about doing more with less? We will ask Clarence Carter, Director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can analytics and risk management lead to better decision-making? What is FEMA doing to forge a 21st century emergency response system? How is the federal government greening its operations? What are some of the opportunities and challenges facing those implementing a national health IT agenda? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. we bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, Michelle Moore, the Federal Environmental Executive, Dr. David Blumenthal, National Coordinator for Health IT, Ambassador Elizabeth Frawley Bagley on the State Department's Global Partnership Initiative, all of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Clarence Carter, Director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services. Also joining us from IBM is Stuart Vansky. Clarence, what have been the effects of the current economic downturn on your programs and clients, and how are you dealing with higher applications and increasing caseloads while facing significant budget reductions?
Michael, I had mentioned that we've seen a 51% increase in homeless families over the course of the last 18 months. We've also had about an 8% increase in our temporary assistance for needy families caseload, about a 20% increase in our food stamp caseloaders, and about a 13% increase in our Medicaid caseload. So all across the board for all of our supports, there has been a significant increase in application and utilization of these safety net programs. And it has been a real challenge in this very resource-constrained time. But we've done some pretty creative things. We had, when I began, 7 service centers. And we were spending about $30 million annually in bricks and mortar. And quite frankly, a building never fed anybody. And so one of the things that we've done is we've reconfigured our service center mix and gotten out of some of those leases so we could be able to not reduce our programs and services. And so we have been able to, in this very resource-constrained time, although we've had to reduce our budget over the last 3 years, each year for the last 3 years, we have been able, for the most part, to not impact programs because we were able to be creative and put the resources in basically serving the people. But there has been a significant increase in utilization of these programs over the course of this period of time.
Now, some of the stats you've mentioned, I think you had mentioned a 51% increase in homeless families. I hasten to ask, but do you see any signs of turnaround in this regard? And are things getting better or are they stabilizing?
For our other benefit programs, the SNAP program, the TANF program, the Medicaid and the Alliance, there does seem to be some slowdown in the rate of growth. Now, this homeless family issue, it seems to still be trending upward. We think there may be some light at the end of the tunnel, but we've not seen the turnaround just yet.
And you mentioned earlier, Clarence, that the federal level, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, provided some additional funds to the district in human service delivery. To what extent has any of the programs that you lead leveraged Recovery Act funding? And how are you tracking and reporting on some of the transparency and accountability requirements associated with that money?
We have leveraged the 2 opportunities that are available to the Department of Human Services. I spoke a little bit about the Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Initiative. That was $7.5 million that was available to the district that has allowed us to divert some families and individuals from homelessness, okay, and then to help also house some folks. And in addition to HPRP, through the Recovery Act, there was an augment to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which would allow jurisdictions to earn about half of their annual grant for increases in caseload and spending on socially and economically challenged individuals and families. And so our annual TANF grant is about $92 million. So we were able to earn an additional $46 million through the Recovery Act. And so we are in the process of, we've submitted application to the feds for the first portion of that. We have received $23 million of that. And so we think that by the end of this year, we will have drawn down a full $46 million that would not have been available to us without the Recovery Act. And the way that the mayor has created a centralized reporting process for all ERA expenditures. So we are required to report every dime of this that we expend, and the district pretty aggressively reports each dollar spent and what it was that was done with those dollars.
Right. Earlier, you mentioned a little bit about the department's income maintenance administration's service centers and how you've reconfigured this. Can you explain a little bit more about the services provided at these centers and what you've done to enhance customer service, streamline the workflow, and make things better for clients?
Sure, Stuart. At our income maintenance service centers, of course, individuals can apply for the complete suite of benefit programs that are eligible through Department of Human Services, and that would be, of course, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, the SNAP program, the Medicaid program, or the District Universal Healthcare Program, the Alliance. Also, there is an Interim Disability Program, a Child Care Subsidy Program. So you can apply for all of those benefit programs through a service center. And also, of course, everything that you would need to do to recertify to continue to receive those benefits where you're still eligible for them. And as you can imagine, with the kinds of caseload increases that we talked to you about, we have seen some dramatic increase in utilization of those service centers. So we've developed some tracking tools, which would allow our service center managers to be able to predict trends and spikes in utilization to be able to redeploy staff to try to address some of those circumstances. And now we are in the process of developing an electronic single point of entry, which would allow for an individual to access the district's benefits, goods, and services through the internet, through phone, through the mail, through kiosk, so that in the very near future, an individual will never have to enter a service center in order to be able to receive benefits. It makes no sense in the 21st century why someone has to come to a government building when whether or not they are eligible for these benefits is a simple issue of the exchange of information. And so we are make it so that we can exchange that information through many different mechanisms so that that customer, just like you don't have to go into a bank to receive your money, you will not have to go into a service center to be able to receive service in the very near future.
You mentioned earlier we were talking about the fundamental drive of many of these programs, which is towards self-sufficiency, to help clients achieve self-sufficiency, which in many ways means a meaningful job. Would you elaborate on some of the barriers you see today that clients face in finding appropriate employment?
Stuart, first, I would take a little bit of exception with your characterization. We hope as a society, I think, that people would be self-sufficient, but we literally don't design and operate these programs to achieve that objective. And part of my argument is that that's what we need to do. We need to be intentional about these programs being designed and operated to that end. But one of the challenges, significant challenges that we have in the district is many of our customers don't have the remedial skills and abilities to be able to avail themselves of existing training and development opportunities. Most of these, the training and development opportunities that are available require a GED and at least a ninth grade reading level. And many of our customers, many, unfortunately, don't have that very remedial ability. So our challenge is to first get them up to a level where they could avail themselves of the training opportunities for the jobs that are out there. Very much in the district, our customers are almost cemented in poverty because of this not having many of these very remedial skill sets. And so our challenge through assessment and then trying to grow their capacity to be able to meet these minimum skill levels is to get them to the place where they then can take advantage of training and development opportunities that will allow them to get meaningful employment. But we have to get them up to that basic level first. And that provides for us the basic challenge to reducing poverty in the district.
And that's a fundamental element of your reform vision.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is, yes.
And Clarence, performance management, evaluation are important tools to doing a lot of what you're talking about in terms of analyzing the effectiveness of these programs and making a difference. To that end, would you describe your evaluation strategy? How do you assess performance of programs that are under your purview?
And Michael, in all candor, I'm embarrassed to say that we have not done that well at all. I have developed recently an Office of Accountability. I'm in the process of reengineering an Office of Information Systems so that we collect the data and do much more rigorous analysis of our programs, that we should be in a position where we plan what we are going to do, we do that, we learn from it and feed that back. We don't have this continuous loop. And so that's what we have built, and I am hoping in the very, very near future, we are going to have a much more rigorous performance management apparatus, which does allow us to learn from what we are doing. But we are in the very infant stages of building that.
So as a follow-up, how do you use or do you use performance-based contracts in order to enable a focus on client outcomes rather than, say, process or unit outputs? Are there any drawbacks to using this?
We actually are with... the change in our homeless services system, the revamping of our homeless services system, we are going to this fall performance-based contracts. And the performance, the basis of those performance is going to be growing the capacity of that customer we serve, not simply providing shelter, okay, not simply providing a unit of service, but actually being intentional about growing the capacity of that customer. Now, this is going to be new for us. So the next time we get a chance to chat, I hope I'll be able to give you some more information about how performance-based contracting is working for us. But we think it is an absolute key component to and for performance to be based on growing the capacity of the customer and not simply performance, which is in delivering a unit of service.
So it's a really interesting and integral part of your whole transformation effort.
It absolutely is.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit here and talk about some recent history, the unfortunate Benita Jacks case, which was a tragedy that made national headlines. Would you elaborate on the working relationship with other city social services agencies that it some assessments was one of the issues involved in the Benita Jacks case, and what's being done to ensure that a tragedy like that never happens again?
The city council passed the Jacks-Fogel legislation, which is a data sharing that would allow us to share information across agencies so that we can better serve clients that have circumstances across our agencies. And that's the first in a number of different mechanisms and protocols that we are developing that will allow us to better operate across programs and across agencies to serve folks. I think the Office of Inspector General did a report following the Jacks tragedy, and one of the things that it laid out was that agencies operated in their own vacuum, and a number of different agencies touched this family, but we didn't do it in concert. Okay? Everybody operated very much in their own lane, and it goes back, from my perspective, to the basic problem I talked about in the human services system, not only do we have individual program silos, we have individual agency silos with everybody having their own individual authority, okay? And with no one really having authority for the individual or family, okay? And so we are attempting in the district to build a whole new construct which allows us, one, in instances of crisis, to actually have a team which is dedicated to working directly with that family to remediate the crisis, but also working across agencies to coordinate the care so that those individuals or families don't fall through the cracks of our system. So we are attempting, and our person-first model is central to this new system redesign, which will allow us to focus more intentionally on the individual or family and less on the program that we're serving.
Clarence, I wanted to ask you about the kinds of private-public partnerships you engage in at DHS, and how do you see them impacting the outcomes of your programs?
First, we have a pretty robust set of community partnerships, because we simply could not do everything that we are required to do by ourselves. Okay? And so there are a number of community-based organizations that DHS partners with to, you know, whether the issue is teen pregnancy or adult protective services or actually case management for a number of the families that we serve. Those partnerships help us to be able to deliver those services. And I think at the core of that question has to be an understanding that no government, no agency, no program is in and of itself the silver bullet. If we don't reach out and collectively knit together the community to solve these problems, the whole cannot be greater than the sum of its parts. So we very aggressively use those kinds of partnerships to help us get our work done.
What does the future hold for DC's Department of Human Services? We will ask Clarence Carter, its director, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. And we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts in greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. And find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Clarence Carter, director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services. Also joining us from IBM is Stuart Vansky. Clarence, leading an agency in the district is unique in that you play the role played usually by state and local governments, and sometimes with congressional oversight, which I'm sure is always fun. Does that pose a unique complication for DHS, and what are some of the complications and issues you field?
Michael, the truth is it actually really poses some unique benefits in that there is not that additional layer in most places. There is first the federal government, then the state, then the locality. In some instances, you may even have the county in that. And so each of those layers have their own set of rules or other complications they bring to it. Well, in the district, you can deal with both of those at the sort of at the city and state level. So we don't actually have an extra set of complications. And the other, I think, value that that I don't understand, or at least it is my perception, that has not been mined the way it could be, that we are working to mine here, is the proximity to the federal apparatus, in that we want to demonstrate this person-centric model of this human services system. Well, because all of our federal partners and their rules are right down the street and around the corner from us, we can actually sit with them and have them help us design a package of waivers that allow us to model this system. So because of our proximity to the federal government, we believe we can very much be a laboratory for actually reinventing the system. So while there is uniqueness to this configuration, I think it actually provides some benefits.
We talked a little bit earlier about the goal of programs and self-sufficiency. What lessons have you learned, or do you think the agency has learned, about from welfare reform and its attempts to move clients in need to self-sufficiency?
I think, Stuart, that the most important component of moving folks to self-sufficiency is intentionality. Okay, that must be your objective, and with that, with that being your objective, you will then figure out how to achieve that objective. And quite frankly, it's been my argument that that really hasn't been the intention of the system. And so, if we can agree that it is our intention to move that individual or family beyond, then that will allow us to figure out how to reconfigure our system, how to test our system, how to measure our system on achieving that objective.
If I can, and then how to target, I think what you're saying is also how to target resources and services more effectively, so you're spending money and time on the things that move people to self-sufficiency and not spending money and time on the things that, don't.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So on a related note, then, how do you see technology as being able to enhance the service delivery and to improve client outcomes and help move people to self-sufficiency more effectively?
In Stuart, in significant ways, because as I've argued earlier, because of the construct of our existing system, this aggregation of individual programs and agencies, it is not easy for us to be able to pull all this stuff together. Well, technology actually allows us to do that, and allows us to do that, one, without having to rip and replace existing systems. The evolution of technology has allowed us to, through things like middleware, connect the systems so that instead of us ripping and replacing numbers of systems, we can link them together, and I can find the customer amongst all of those systems simply by linking them together. So this sort of person-first approach that I've talked about, while the legal and regulatory construct of the human services system doesn't currently support it, technology actually allows us to operate in that fashion. So it's a huge benefit to us while we try to build the bridge to tomorrow to actually make the system constructed this way.
Well, speaking about the bridge to tomorrow, I'd like to transition to the future. And what are some of the major opportunities and challenges you see your agency facing in the future? And how do you envision it addressing those challenges?
Michael, I think the major challenge is twofold. It is first convincing the policymakers that the construct of our system of human care is a broken construct, and that it does not, in the best way possible, serve socially and economically challenged people, so that the construct of that system must change. That's the first thing, making that case. Then the second difficulty is the reconstructing of a system to do so. Right? I think those are the two biggest challenges facing our industry today. I think that there is a sense that our human services system fails because there's not enough money, fails because there's not enough will, okay? I would be honest with you, I think we don't achieve the objectives that we want to achieve because we have a failed construct. And explaining that and getting the groundswell that would allow for the massive change that has to take place in the system, I think is the greatest challenge confronting the system over the course of the next 3 to 5 years.
A very compelling perspective. I wanted to ask you, what advice would you give to someone thinking about a career in public service, and in particular, those interested in working in human service delivery?
Michael, the advice that I would give folks is that there is an emerging perfect storm that I think will dramatically change this industry over the course of the next 3 to 5 to 7 years. I would suggest that for anyone who wants to get in to this line of work, that they would be getting in on the ground floor of changing the system, and that the time could not be better to get into it. Now, I would say that with one caveat. If indeed one needs to have a well-functioning, everything thought out kind of operation, this is not the place to be for a while, because it's going to be very chaotic, okay? But if you're an architect, if you want to build a system of care, I think this is the place to be. This industry is the place to be for the next 5 to 7 years.
Clarence, that's terrific advice. I want to thank you for joining us today. But more importantly, Stuart and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the District of Columbia and to those most in need.
Michael and Stuart, thanks an awful lot for the opportunity. I care passionately about this work. And I just believe that we can do better by that individual or family that finds themselves in need of the basic assistance that we provide to help make their lives work. And so while we want to continue to be diligent to providing those benefits, goods, and services that we have available to us right now, we want to be equally as diligent about raising the flag, raising the collective voice that we can do better as a safety net for those people that desperately need us. It's been my pleasure to be here with you this afternoon.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Clarence Carter, Director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services. My co-host from IBM has been Stuart Vansky. And be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
How is TRICARE delivering a consistent, equitable, and cost-efficient pharmacy benefit to our troops and their families? What science and technology research is being done at the Naval Surface Warfare Center? And how can the use of analytics and risk management lead to better decisions? Pick up the spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. The latest edition of the Business of Government magazine provides insights from Rear Admiral Thomas McGinnis, who leads DOD's Pharmacy Benefit Program, and Rear Admiral James Shannon, commander of the Naval Surface Warfare Center. Tom Davenport, author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning, kicks off our forum with an in-depth conversation on the strategic importance of analytics, how government can leverage analytics, and the ways to improve decision-making using analytics. All of this and so much more in the spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org.
How does technology transform social services in New York City? What about data center consolidation? How can technology improve outcomes and responsiveness? Listen next week as these questions and more will be explored with Richard Seamer, Deputy Commissioner and CIO at the New York City Human Resources Administration, on the Business of Government Hour.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy Midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics and your source for federal news now.
CNN.